content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 27th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows in the foreground, it's an army jeep, sort of the olive green typical color. Sitting on the hood are looks like three Taliban fighters. Two of them have machine guns. One of them has a rocket launcher. They're looking into the foreground. To the side of them looks like an Afghan father with a young child. The background is kind of hazy, and off in the distance you see an American cargo plane. Looks like it's taking another round of refugees away. And the headline is, "A Shameful Ending. Is Biden to Blame for the Taliban's Victory in Afghanistan?" That's our first main story and the controversy of the week, and we'll take both of those. Biden defends U.S. pullout as Afghanistan fails. What happened? A defiant President Biden stood behind his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan as the Taliban seized the country this week, bringing a two-decade campaign of counterterrorism and nation-building to a chaotic end. Thousands of Afghans fleeing Taliban rule flooded the tarmac of Kabul's international airport, where videos showed several people clinging to the wheels of a departing U.S. C-17 cargo plane, then falling from midair to their deaths after takeoff. Military helicopters evacuated staff from the U.S. embassy, evoking images of the fall of Saigon that the Biden administration had desperately hoped to avoid. In the presidential palace, Taliban fighters toted Kalashnikovs and posed for photos, completing their conquest of Kabul after Afghanistan's U.S.-trained army folded with little resistance. In an address to the nation, Biden declared, "The buck stops with me," then pointed his finger at the Afghan army, Afghan officials, and Donald Trump, who last year signed a peace deal with the Taliban that required all U.S. troops to withdraw by May 1st. Biden postponed that day, but never wavered from his insistence on a full withdrawal, although top generals and intelligence officials reportedly warned it could lead to the government's quick collapse. "It is wrong to order American troops to step up when Afghanistan's own armed forces would not," Biden said, adding that their failure to fight shows that leaving was the right decision. Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid gave his first press briefing, vowing there would be no reprisals and that women's rights would be respected under Islamic law. Some Afghan protesters, however, were shot dead in the streets. U.S. officials said it had warned the Taliban not to interfere as it evacuates thousands of U.S. citizens and Afghans who assisted in its 20-year campaign, although those without proper documentation are being turned away at Taliban and U.S. checkpoints. Among those who departed safely was now ex-president Ashraf Ghani, who reportedly fled to the United Arab Emirates with dozens of his aides in tow, along with bags with $169 million in cash stuffed into four cars at a helicopter. What the editorial said: Biden is the main architect of this needless American surrender, said the Wall Street Journal, and yet he has refused to accept responsibility. Instead, he has blamed the Afghan army and Trump, whose peace deal with the Taliban was indeed a mistake. By framing the withdrawal as a way to save U.S. soldiers from more bloodshed, Biden will no doubt appeal to Americans who are tired of foreign military missions. But there was no mere civil war. We were there for 20 years to prevent Afghanistan from again becoming a terrorist safe haven. And the Taliban's victory will now attract thousands of young jihadists eager to attack the West. Biden was right to bring the war to a close, said the New York Times, but it should never have ended in such chaos. Leaving 2,500 troops in Afghanistan would only have delayed, not prevented, an inevitable Taliban victory. His decision to leave took courage and wisdom, but his administration did not do enough to protect the Afghans who worked with the U.S. or the girls and women who had embraced a measure of equality. Tragically, the American dream of promoting democracy and human rights in this troubled region proved to be just that, a dream. What the columnist said. The U.S. is betraying millions of Afghans, said Ruki Kumar and thedailybeast.com. Desperate Afghans who work for the U.S. or the Afghan government are still flooding Kabul's airport, clinging to the tiniest hope that foreign planes will save them from Taliban vengeance. Now the Taliban are executing perceived opponents in the streets, cutting off the limbs of those accused as thieves, and forcefully marrying women off. America, this is your legacy. Biden made the difficult but necessary choice, said Daniel Silverberg in theatlantic.com. The Taliban are stronger now than they have been since 2001, and Afghan soldiers, sick of corruption and not getting paid, were already deserting the army en masse. If Biden had reneged on Trump's deal to withdraw all U.S. troops, the Taliban would have launched a major offensive and resumed attacking our soldiers. To keep the Afghan government from falling, Biden would have been forced to send thousands of troops back in, starting the cycle of futility again. The status quo was not sustainable, and those who argue otherwise are engaging in fantasies. I fear for my Afghan sisters, said Malala Yousafzai in the New York Times. Millions of Afghan women and girls who received an education are now in despair as the future they were promised is stripped away. Some Taliban members say they will let women and girls go to school. Don't believe them. When I was 15 in Pakistan, the Taliban tried to kill me when I spoke up for my rights to an education. I cannot imagine going back to a life defined for me by men with guns. In the controversy of the week, Afghanistan, was it all a waste? As President Biden takes heat for withdrawing from Afghanistan too early after 20 years of war, said Zeeshan Alim in MSNBC.com, the sudden collapse of the U.S.-backed Afghan government and armed forces should finally prove that our extended occupation of the country was always a mistake. Back in 2001, the initial goals of the U.S. invasion, toppling the Taliban and routing al-Qaeda, were accomplished within months. But then the mission morphed into a neocon fantasy of transforming a tribal, desperately poor, largely illiterate, and deeply religious society into another country, modeled on Western democracies. To achieve this mission impossible in what was already known as the graveyard of empires, we sacrificed 2,300 U.S. soldiers, 3,800 American contractors, 66,000 Afghan soldiers and police, and at least 47,000 Afghan civilians. With fundamental hubris, we also squandered $133 billion on reconstruction and Afghan military training, at least $1 trillion more on the U.S. military mission, all to see the Taliban we routed in 2001 roll into Kabul without a fight. The comparison to Vietnam is inevitable and bitterly appropriate, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. In Southeast Asia, Lebanon, Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan, the U.S. has proved it can't build nations or conclusively put down insurgencies. Our latest epic defeat by a ragtag army of perhaps 60,000 Taliban will leave America's standing abroad profoundly weakened. Was it worth it? Asked James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO forces, in Time.com. Let's remember that the primary purpose of our staying in Afghanistan after 9/11 was to prevent another attack on the U.S. homeland emanating from that ungoverned space. And for 20 years, we did that. Meanwhile, thanks to our efforts, Afghan life expectancy increased dramatically, and millions of women gained the freedom to pursue education and careers. Yes, all of these gains are now at risk, but those who served can hold their heads up with pride. Our leaders cannot, said David Korn in MotherJones.com. In 2019, the Washington Post obtained classified documents showing that four successive administrations consistently hoodwinked the public into thinking we had a clear strategy for Afghanistan. Behind the scenes, Army General Douglas Lute, who served as Afghan war czar for Presidents Bush and Obama, admitted, "We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." If the initial invasion had captured or killed Osama bin Laden, said Matthew Iglesias in SlowBoring.com, Bush could have declared victory and brought our troops home. Or he could have wholeheartedly committed to nation building. But when bin Laden escaped, Bush switched focus to invading and nation building in Iraq, and Afghanistan became a halfway war we couldn't win. That half-heartedness reflected U.S. public sentiment, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal. Once the war lost its original and narrow purpose, defanging Al-Qaeda, Americans mostly stopped paying attention and essentially just wanted out. In the end, said Tom Nichols in TheAtlantic.com, all of us own this defeat. With our lack of interest and deep ambivalence, we incentivized our leaders to simply keep the war off the front pages, which they dutifully did, while pretending that the humiliating defeat now unfolding wasn't inevitable. This day came about for one reason and one reason only. Because it is what we wanted. Here's our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for the right stuff after the U.S. Air Force relaxed its dress and appearance rules to permit scalp tattoos, piercing spacers, and a half inch more of hair, and no hosiery for women's dress uniforms. The USAF said that changes will maintain our focus on warfighting while providing options to meet many of the needs of our airmen. It was a good week for the friendly skies after United Airlines asked staff not to duct tape unruly passengers into their seats and rely instead on professionalism and composure that have set us apart. It was a good week for reliable reviews after a tourist visiting Loch Ness in Scotland left it a vicious one-star TripAdvisor review complaining that the Loch's famous monster never showed up. Don't go if you are wanting to see it, warned the reviewer, because you will end up bitterly disappointed like we were. But it was a bad week for self-medication, with new research showing U.S. alcohol consumption rose 39% during the pandemic and 323% among mothers, with young children. It was a bad week for Madison Cawthorn, 25-year-old Republican congressman who tweeted that George Orwell's 1984 is a great fiction novel to read, but it seems like it is becoming the reality we are currently living under. As critics noted, all novels are by definition fiction. And it was also a bad week for actual Orwellianism after China's Ministry of Culture said it was creating a new list of banned songs for the country's 50,000 karaoke bars, including any lyrics that threaten national unity. The current blacklist includes such subversive title classics as Don't Want to Go to School, I Love Taiwanese Girls, and Fart. And a short and other news piece before we move on. U.S. will raise food stamp benefits. The Biden administration plans to increase food stamp benefits by 25%, the largest permanent increase in the history of a program that feeds 42 million Americans. The New York Times reported this week, under the new rules set to take effect in October, average monthly benefits, $121 per person before the pandemic, will rise by $36, adding $20 billion in annual cost to the government program. Benefits use a sliding scale, and the new maximum will rise to $835 a month for a family of four. The adjustments can be made under a 2018 law passed with bipartisan support that put changes in the hands of the Agriculture Department. More than three-quarters of households exhaust their benefits in the first half of each month. Briefing this week is titled Erasing Native American Culture. The U.S. and Canada are starting to face their history of forcing indigenous children into abusive boarding schools. What was the school's goal? Simply put, cultural genocide. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the U.S. government and religious leaders used compulsory boarding schools to force young Native Americans to give up the languages and cultures of their ancestors, which were considered self-evidently inferior to a Christian Western-style upbringing. Boarding schools were made mandatory for Native American children in 1891. This often meant forced separation from their families and communities, and because these schools were underfunded, crowded, and often unsanitary, thousands of students died of disease. Canada also coerced at least 150,000 indigenous children into a network of residential schools that were mostly run by the Catholic Church. Last June, researchers uncovered 1,148 unmarked graves on the grounds of three schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, a member of the Laguna Pueblo people whose maternal grandparents were forced to board, has opened an investigation into America's boarding school policy. This attempt to wipe out Native identity, language, and culture, she wrote in a June Washington Post article, has never been appropriately addressed. Who ran boarding schools in the U.S.? Of the 367 boarding schools for Native Americans known to have operated in the U.S., the federal government operated more than half, the Catholic Church about 100, and many others were run by various Protestant denominations. In 1879, the first off-reservation government school was founded by Richard Henry Pratt, an Army general who had overseen the education of Native American prisoners of war. The first 86 students recruited for the Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, were Lakota Sioux. Pratt convinced Lakota leaders that education was critical to their people's survival, but later wrote that he had planned to make the children hostages for the good behavior of their people. Pratt rejected then popular notions of white biological superiority, but he said his mission for each student was to kill the Indian in him and save the man. What was life like for the students? They were essentially treated like prisoners. On arrival at the school, the long hair of both boys and girls, which had deep spiritual significance for many indigenous peoples, was typically shorn. Children were compelled to discard their traditional clothes and take English names. In later years, new students were doused with DDT. They were forbidden from speaking their own languages, and the ban was often enforced with corporal punishment. At both government and church-run schools, physical and sexual abuse were rife. Students were expected to perform daily manual labor, and instead of being allowed home, students were often sent on summer outings to local white families, where they worked as farmhands or domestic servants for little or no pay. Because of limited indoor plumbing in dorms and poor ventilation, infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, the flu, and smallpox spread quickly. A student at Carlisle, Luther Standing Bear, recalled nearly half of his fellow Lakota classmates dying. At some institutions, students were expected to make coffins for their classmates in school workshops. Was there any resistance? Escapes were so common that some schools offered bounties for the return of runaways. Many parents also resisted sending their children away, though the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs could withhold food from those who refused to comply. In 1894, the Hopi residents in what is now Arizona fought against armed soldiers in an effort to keep their children at home. "Our children were taken by force," one Hopi leader later recalled. "They were dragged from the fields and from the rocks and from their homes, and if they were hid away, they were shot at." Eventually, 19 Hopi men were arrested and sent to Alcatraz. When did the schools close? In the 1960s and 70s, the Pan-Indian movement demanded the right to self-determine education. Finally, in 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act abolished compulsory boarding school education. Most of the remaining boarding schools closed soon after, but 15 schools are still taking boarders with modified educational goals. How is this history being addressed? Holland has requested that the Department of Interior make a final report next April. Last month, Sikanga Lakota of South Dakota successfully brought home the remains of 9 children and teenagers who died at Carlisle. In 2008, the Jesuits paid $5 million to 16 people who said they were sexually abused by clergy at a Washington State boarding school. So far, the Vatican has not issued a formal apology for the church's mistreatment of indigenous children in Catholic boarding schools. The United States government also has not issued a specific apology for forced boarding. A 2020 congressional bill that would have created a Truth and Reconciliation Commission died in committee. Native American survivors and activists say that the work to reckon with this chapter of American history is just beginning. "This isn't some kind of isolated history chapter," said University of Iowa historian Jackie Thompson Rand, a member of the Choctaw Nation. "We're all still paying for it." And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two from the U.S. The case for vaccine mandates. Vaccination mandates are as American as apple pie, said Max Boot. Ever since George Washington forced his troops to be inoculated against smallpox in 1777, we've used mandatory vaccinations to prevent the spread of infectious diseases. Today, every state requires that school children be inoculated against a host of viral illnesses, and the Supreme Court has twice upheld vaccination mandates. Yet here we are amid the deadliest plague in a century, and many Republicans adamantly opposed vaccination mandates by private employers, restaurants, schools, and businesses. This pseudo-libertarianism is absurd and hypocritical. When it comes to stopping terrorism and crimes, conservatives have proved themselves perfectly willing to accept substantial infringements on civil liberties. Yet they now insist it's purely a matter of personal choice whether to get and spread COVID, which has killed more Americans than every war in our history combined. The unvaccinated impose a heavy cost on the rest of us, filling hospitals, requiring expensive care, threatening in-person schooling, and promoting breakthrough infections among the vaccinated. With only 61% of Americans fully vaccinated and Delta wreaking havoc, personal choice isn't working. To participate in society, people should be required to get a shot. Obama's tone-deaf narcissism. Democrats usually let a few years pass before admitting that their elected officials, like Ted Kennedy and Bill Clinton, had glaring flaws, said Jim Garrity. This appears to be the moment when Democrats feel comfortable publicly ripping into Barack Obama. After the former president threw himself an opulent 60th birthday party at his $12 million Martha's Vineyard estate last week, many progressives admitted it came off as tone-deaf and narcissistic in the midst of the Delta surge. The bash under a massive tent was supposedly scaled back, but Obama still surrounded himself with dozens of maskless A-list movie stars, musicians, athletes, and other celebrities. In the New York Times, columnist Maureen Dowd bemoaned how Obama had been corrupted by his post-presidential wealth. But come on, Obama has always been this guy. During his presidency, Obama hobnobbed with A-list stars, threw dozens of celebrity-filled White House parties at taxpayer expense, and frequently went on TV shows to yuck it up. This is the same guy who once lectured the rich for indifference to income inequality. "There's only so big a house you can have," he said. How rich? This is an international column from Russia. Why Siberia is going up in flames. We can't blame climate change alone for the wildfires that are choking the residents of Siberia and spreading smoke as far as Alaska, said Georgi Boft. It's true that Siberia has warmed twice as fast as the global average over the past few decades, but the frightening heat wave we're enduring this year is also baking other Arctic nations, and their fires are nowhere near as bad as Russia's. We have a staggering 33 million acres of flame, seven times the territory burning in Canada, and many times that of Finland. Those countries simply do a much better job at forest management. Siberia, of course, doesn't have the natural river fire breaks that are found in Finland, but we've also failed to build man-made ones such as roads. Attempts at such protective measures were abandoned thanks to the Forest Code of 2006, President Vladimir Putin's attempt to save cash by shunting responsibility for forests from the federal government to the provinces. The results have been catastrophic. The regions simply don't have the money for fire prevention and are forced to fight the resulting out-of-control blazes with creaky 30-year-old equipment. Until we're willing to commit the necessary resources, Siberia will continue to burn and Russians will continue to suffer. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week is Welcome to Crypto Land. I wanted to understand what all the cryptocurrency noise was about, said journalist David Segal in the New York Times. The best way to learn was by starting my own hype coin scam. They have names that make them sound delicious, like Cookie Coin, or headed for outer space like Pluto Coin, or spacebound and delicious like Astro Cake, which was described this way. Created 5 minutes ago. Safe. Hype coins, as they're known, sit squarely on the flashy, speculative end of the cryptocurrency business. Every day, dozens of them are created around the world by developers promising fortunes to would-be investors. It usually ends poorly. The vast majority of these tokens are worthless within a couple of weeks. The developers, on the other hand, can make tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes a lot more. Despite this track record, hype coins have become the investment of choice for millions of people, most of them men in their 30s or younger, and convinced that the economy writ large is rigged against them. To them, crypto is both a source of hope in imminent riches and fellowship. Many coins have chats on Telegram, an encrypted messaging app that can sound like faith-based support groups. You may have heard that Bitcoin, the granddaddy of crypto, is mined by power-gobbling supercomputers, a process that verges on the utterly incomprehensible. Making a hype coin, by contrast, is more like ordering a pizza online. The entire process is automated and speedy. The fixings in this case, what to call it, how many coins to make, and so on, are up to you. So one day in May, I created my own cryptocurrency. I did it on a Zoom call with an excitable 36-year-old in Taiwan, Dan Ariola, who had posted a tutorial on YouTube about how to make and promote a scam coin. It has more than 240,000 views. The lowest cost to launch a token is $8, he said during our call. That's if you use a site for the tech savvy. For everyone else, there's CoinTool. After a few minutes of tweaking and about $300 in fees, I pressed a button. Instantly, 21 million coins were minted. I christened them Idiot Coins. I had a website built with a how to buy section that warned against it. Step one, do not buy Idiot Coin. I wrote an announcement for Crypto Moonshots, a Reddit page where newborn crypto is unveiled. Usually the coins are breathlessly flogged for their imminent moonward trajectory. I took a different tack. Def not going to the moon, my announcement read, might not get an inch off the ground. The dream of instant riches has been around for as long as money. Only the source of the fortune changes. Gold, tulips, and mortgage-backed securities have all taken a turn as the surefire investment vehicle of choice for investors in a hurry. Now it's cryptocurrencies. The uninitiated may have the sense that a couple dozen of them are out there. The actual number is closer to 70,000, according to a site called Token Sniffer. About 100 are created each day. Most hype coins, though, end in rug pulls, a maneuver in which developers and their allies cash out their tokens as they peak amid a burst of carefully orchestrated advertising. The price plummets, trading ends. On the Coinopsy website, there's a list of a few thousand dead coins. The most common causes of death are scam and abandoned. The true believers are bleeding but undaunted. The rise of crypto feels inevitable to them as the perfect rebuke to a banking system they neither like nor trust. Plus, hype coins have elements of a spectator sport. There's a sense that the louder a coin's fans shout on social media rather than in the stands, the richer they will get. Frenetically boosting a coin online is known as shilling, and everyone in the cryptosphere knows people who shilled one night and were flushed the next morning, like Jashil Tolia, a 31-year-old dental student from the north of England. In the hours after the debut of a hype coin called Bonfire on April 18th, he had invested $30,000, largely because he liked the look of the logo and the energy of the Telegram community. He and other holders then left hashtag Bonfire Token and other pro-Bonfire tags all over the web, like a swarm of graffiti artists on uppers. By the time Tolia woke, Bonfire had gone parabolic, as they say in crypto circles. His coins were worth $1.4 million. I'd made $1 million before, but over the course of 3 or 4 days, he said in an interview in May, I'd never made $1 million overnight. Friends and allies are essential in crypto land. I met mine in March when I joined a WhatsApp thread of enthusiasts that is based in the London suburb of Chingford. Every day, about 200 people in the crypto crew, as it's called, trade tips and offer advice. Before the current downturn, about once a week, someone in the crew would pipe up with the name of the latest hype coin and a question in the vein of, hey guys, have you any thoughts on this one? In early May, it was Bonfire. It had recently gone up 700%. On the chat, a couple of members swooned. The skeptics were not far behind. You might imagine that a visit to Cryptoland is all about shiny surfaces and precision, like running around the inside of a Swiss watch. It's more like a bog where all the roads are unpaved and half the signs are written by lunatics. The websites are mostly slow, buggy, and confounding. Nearly every step requires a pause to watch a YouTube tutorial. As bad, Cryptoland is swarming with scammers. Some are waiting for an errant keystroke so your money can be intercepted, never to be returned. Some make look-alike copies of apps that you need to download, which makes your assets easy to grab. Some produce knockoffs of currencies you want to buy. Dozens of coins are called Bitcoin, for example. The first of many scammers I encountered in Cryptoland showed up near the end of my quest to buy Bonfire. By then, I had lumbered through about a dozen steps and finally landed on PancakeSwap, a decentralized finance exchange, DeFi for short, where crypto can be swapped without an intermediary. When I finally hit the swap button, my Bonfire seemed to vanish for an hour. Then two. My Bonfire coins, it turned out, were simply delayed by online congestion. The journey from PancakeSwap to my crypto wallet took 4.5 hours, which pointed up another surprise about crypto land. It's absurdly slow. Soon after the coins arrived, Bonfire's run-up ended. The value of the coin and every other cryptocurrency started to plunge. This was actually Bonfire's second near-death experience. The first happened a few days after its birth in April, when it became clear that its developer had conceived the coin as a pump and dump. The developer had sold nearly all his coins after Bonfire's initial rise. But Tolia and a team of like-minded holders decided they would try to rescue the coin from oblivion. Nobody would get paid for the time being, but that didn't matter. This was a mission. At the time, Bonfire had a market cap of more than $26 million, and within a few weeks, about 200,000 holders. Tolia leveled with him. On YouTube and Telegram, he explained that they had all bought into a scam. Now, he argued, Bonfire could become a community and, with enough patience and focus, a thriving business. He pitched the idea that the coin could serve as the backbone of an alternative to Facebook, one with real privacy and no ads. Most holders were delighted. Tolia was hailed as a hero and a saint on Bonfire's Telegram account. He was ecstatic. He had spent years studying dentistry, in part because so many others in his family had joined the profession. But it had never felt like his calling. "I've always wanted to do something big," Tolia said in an interview in May, "something with a futuristic vision." Shortly after, though, China imposed new restrictions on its financial system. China's more move against crypto sent the price of Bonfire into freefall. By June, many Bonfire holders were selling. They were often denounced for spreading FUD, a ubiquitous acronym in the cryptosphere that stands for fear, uncertainty, and doubt. By June, it took about 7.7 million Bonfire coins to equal $1. While brutal for Bonfire's early holders, infinitesimal prices are part of the appeal for many hype coin fans. The first bitcoins ever traded were reportedly valued at a fraction of a cent. If the price of a coin like Bonfire ever reached a penny, holders would be spectacularly rich. Unfortunately, the 1 cent mark is impossible. That's because staggering quantities of tokens are typically minted. 650 trillion in Bonfire's case. Were they worth a penny each, the market cap of Bonfire would far exceed those of Apple and Amazon combined, plus Walmart. The core audience of hype coins doesn't seem to care. A few weeks ago, I happened across the Telegram account of FEG Token, another hype coin. The acronym stands for Feed Every Gorilla. Gorillas are nearly as popular as dogs when it comes to coin names. More than 100 people were on FEG's Telegram group voice chat one July afternoon. "Why invest in crypto?" I asked. A guy identified as Bogdan Dancy spoke up. "I live in the Netherlands, and the banks, the whole centralized system, crashed in 2008, and we lost a ton of money," he said. "Why should we pay for a bunch of gamblers in the banking system? Our whole nation got scammed. That's why I moved into this space." Many here have the sense that inflation is eating away at fiat currency and that the stock market is a dangerous bubble. Some people believe that boomers and other older generations have a death grip on the world's wealth and will never hand it over. Crypto is an end run around that problem. "Once you start seeing the potential of this project for the rest of the world," Dancy told me during the Telegram chat, "you will want to start promoting it yourself because it is really game-changing." Before making my own hype coin, I needed to answer a basic question. Would doing so break the law? I was about to create something that sure sounded like a security and put it up for sale for the entire planet. It seemed like the kind of enterprise that might draw unwanted attention from the Securities and Exchange Commission, or regulators in Britain, where I live. I consulted two lawyers who had expertise in the area. The wisest course, the lawyer said, was to ensure that Idiot Coin was utterly hopeless and did not meet the definition of an investment contract. No problem. This coin would be a fiasco. Still, I wanted to go through the hype coin publicity motions, all of them facilitated by an assortment of freelance vendors and websites. First, I made it appear as though a bunch of investors had already snapped up Idiot Coins, a charade made easy by CoinTool. the site's batch wallet generate button instantly created 100 crypto wallets, each with its own 12-word security phrase. For about $70, I put 100 idiot coins in each wallet. There was no way to tell that those wallets had been made by the same person who had created the coin. Now I needed to pitch this stinker to crypto buyers. That meant hiring a TikToker to post an idiot coin exalting video. Through a site called Collabster, I found my dream performer, Samuel Malky, who performs under the name Malky Means King and has 5 million followers. He raps while fanning himself with stacks of fake $100 bills, wearing outrageous eyewear, a gold crown, and cartoonish fake teeth. It's a parody of opulence, confected with props and attitude. I actually live with my parents, he said during a video call on Instagram. In all, the coin and its artificial hoopla cost about $1,000. I had the coin looked over by an auditing firm in Ukraine, Zokio, to make sure it wasn't hackable. Finally, at the appointed hour, on July 2nd, the Crypto Moonshots announcement went up. Malky posted his TikTok. CoinForIdiots.com went live. Nothing happened, or rather, almost nothing. Four people or bots, it's hard to tell, bought a grand total of 73 idiot coins, yielding a small fraction of a penny in sales. It was a total bust, thankfully. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Pick up one of the health and science articles this week. A looming Gulf Stream catastrophe. Climate change has led to an almost complete loss of stability in a crucial system of ocean currents in the Atlantic, a new study has warned, raising fears of a catastrophic collapse. The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, which includes the Gulf Stream, is effectively an aquatic conveyor belt that sends warm, salty water from the tropics to northern Europe and brings cold water south. If this current collapses, the UK and northern Europe would experience drastically lower temperatures and more storms. Sea levels on the east coast of North America would rise sharply, and rains crucial for crop production in India, South America, and West Africa would be heavily disrupted. The new study found that eight different measures of AMOC, going back as far as 150 years, all pointed to one conclusion. A massive influx of fresh water from melting ice sheets and glaciers in Greenland and the Arctic is altering the conveyor belt's strength, reports the Washington Post. The system is not at a tipping point, researchers say, but it's so large and complex that it's impossible to say if or when that will happen. But scientists have recently found that AMOC is at its weakest in more than 1,000 years. And the last time it appears to have collapsed, says study author Nicholas Boers, Europe had an ice age that lasted a millennium. This is a system we don't want to mess with, he said. We'll flip over to the Talking Points page. The census, a shrinking white majority. At some point, at least in most functioning democracies, demography does become destiny, said Harold Meyerson in Prospect.org. Between 2010 and 2020, U.S. Census data revealed last week the white population experienced a stunning numerical and percentage decline. Thanks to a low birth rate among whites, immigration, and a whopping 276% rise in the number of Americans who call themselves multiracial, the country went from 64% white to 58% and is clearly on track to lose its white majority at some point in the 2040s. This might seem like bad news for the Republican Party, which finds its strongest support among whites, said Justin Guest in CNN.com. But because much of America's relatively sluggish 7% population growth occurred in GOP-controlled Sunbelt states, the right can delay and minimize non-white political representation. Four of the six states that will gain seats in the House of Representatives in 2022 have GOP legislative majorities that will control the redistricting process. A perfect storm of factors will help Republicans hold off demographic change, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. When states soon redistrict, Republicans know they can gain the five net seats they need to reclaim the House majority in the 2022 elections through aggressive gerrymandering alone, even if Democratic congressional candidates get more votes in total. Nothing wrong with that, said Noah Wall in the Washington Examiner. Redistricting is a partisan process, always has been, and always will be. Democrats have extensively gerrymandered deep blue Maryland, yet some are still pushing for a federal takeover of elections through the For the People Act. Congressional redistricting is inevitable in a growing nation, and it's better to have elected representatives do it than an independent commission of unaccountable bureaucrats. For the white nativists who now control the GOP, said Charles Blow in the New York Times, the Browning of America must be downright frightening. Republicans are doing their best to suppress non-white votes so they can continue to control purple states like Georgia and Michigan. That's why the Democratic-controlled Senate's inability and unwillingness to alter the filibuster to pass voter protection is so maddening. White America can't maintain its political dominance forever, but people with power fight, sometimes to the end, to maintain it. We'll read some of the short notes now. Last month was the hottest July in more than 142 years of record keeping, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported. The global average was 62.07 degrees Fahrenheit, edging out the previous record set in 2016. The last seven Julys rank as the seven hottest on record. Over the past 10 months, about 20% of migrants arrested at the Mexican border have not been from Mexico or Central America, but from more distant countries such as Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador, Cuba, and Haiti, as people flee the pandemic and political chaos. There is currently no way of returning these migrants to their home countries. Fox News requested appearances by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis 113 times, or nearly once a day, from last November through February, with a producer telling the governor that Fox sees him as the future of the party. Emails from DeSantis to Fox, obtained through a Freedom of Information request, showed that DeSantis' team regularly provided the network with prepackaged topics, talking points, and graphics used on the air. The U.S. economy grew 12.12% last quarter, the first time since 1990 that the American economy grew faster than China's, which had a 7.9% gain. Moody's predicts U.S. growth will outstrip China's for four more consecutive quarters. On the poll watch, 69% of Americans support mandatory masking in schools, including 92% of Democrats, 67% of Independents, and 44% of Republicans. 64% are in favor of state and local governments requiring masks to be worn in public spaces. 33% support state laws like Florida's that ban local governments from mandating masks. 55% support companies requiring all employees to be vaccinated. We had several good quotes today, so I think I've got time for three. We'll start with one from Albert Einstein, who says, "If A is success in life, then A equals X plus Y plus Z. Work is X, play is Y, and Z is keeping your mouth shut." This comes from Dorothy Parker, quoted in Country Living, who says, "The cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity." And finally, from one of my favorite authors, John Updike, quoted in the Chicago Tribune, he says, "We do survive every moment, after all, except the last one." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.